Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to Unheard. So if you are a long-standing fan of this channel, you'll remember that on October the 5th, 2020, during the COVID year, we had an exclusive, a world exclusive interview with three professors who announced something called the Great Barrington Declaration. We broke that story and it was the first time they were seen, all three of them sitting together. I remember it very well. In fact, they got in trouble for not wearing masks and for sitting too close together in that video. That was already considered quite a heretical move. That began a huge story which has upended each of their lives. And one of them, Dr. Martin Kulldorff, who we've spoken to a couple of times on this channel, has just announced that formally he has actually been fired by Harvard. So having been a professor of medicine, a statistician, a disease epidemiologist, he is no longer. And we thought we absolutely had to get him back on the channel, both to hear the circumstances of that, and also now in the cold light of day, some years after, let's take this opportunity to retrace exactly how Harvard behaved as an institution during that story and what lessons we can learn from it. He is just to the west of Boston and he joins us now. Hi, Martin.
Thank you so much, Sam. Thank you for having me.
So I was about to say, hi, professor. I guess you're still professor, but you're not a Harvard professor. Or what is your current status?
Well, I guess I'm not a professor anymore. So for the first time in a long time, but I still consider myself a scientist. That's something you cannot stop being, I think.
So what was the story of that? I know it's obviously a difficult thing for you, and you've only now just spoken about it, but did they fire you? Did you resign? What was the story with Harvard?
Well, I didn't speak about it before because I was focused on the pandemic and sort of ending school closures and other things. And also I figured as long as I was on leave, I wasn't sort of, it hadn't ended formally, even though I was the Harvard's Mass General Hospital, Mass General Brigham Hospitals, they fired me in end of 2021. And then the medical school put me on leave. And then they ended that leave a few months ago.
So were they different processes, the hospital versus the medical school?
Yeah, so one is sort of me getting paid, and the other one is me having a faculty appointment. So they put me on leave, so I was no longer on the faculty, but I was on leave from the faculty. And then they ended that also.
So what was your crime as regards the hospital? How did they manage to get rid of you so quickly?
So there was a disagreement about infection-acquired immunity. So we have known since the Athenian plague in 430 BC that if you recover from a disease, you have immunity. So you're protected the next time you get exposed. And so that's basic scientific knowledge, similar to the fact that the Earth is round rather than flat, which we've also known about for about 2,500 years. But because of these vaccine mandates, they are de facto denying this type of natural immunity or infection-acquired immunity. So by requiring everybody to be vaccinated, they are sort of being very unscientific denying that. And so, for example, there were very many nurses at the Harvard hospitals. They worked during the pandemic taking care of COVID patients. And then they got sick and they were home for maybe a week or two, and then they get back working taking care of COVID patients. But then when the vaccine came, several of them were fired for not taking the vaccine, even though their immunity from having had COVID was stronger than the immunity you get from the vaccine. So that's very unscientific. And I was one of the people who got fired because I had had COVID. So I didn't need the vaccine. And I also have an immune deficiency, a genetic immune deficiency. It's called alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. So it was sort of very unclear for me what the vaccine would do to me because of that.
So you refused to take the vaccine?
Correct, yes.
Despite it being hospital policy, and that's why they fired you?
Yes, and I didn't see any patients, but they also fired many others. But they gave exceptions, both medical and religious exceptions, including to faculty members who saw patients. So they did give exemptions, but they denied my medical exemption.
And were you doing that as a point of principle? This was right in the kind of cauldron of when everyone was thinking and talking about this. Were you trying to make a point and say, I'm not going to do something I don't think is scientific? Or were you more just genuinely worried about your own personal health and didn't want to take the risk of taking the vaccine?
It was both, because it was principle, because I've argued against the vaccine mandate. So then I shouldn't take it if I don't need it. It's also my personal, because of my immune deficiency. It's unclear what the vaccine will do for people with immune deficiencies.
So what do you think went wrong there, though? I mean, if we're going to try and learn from it, I guess a hospital would say they need to be able to have a policy for medical staff on things like vaccines. Might be the wrong policy, might be the right policy, but people have to follow it if they are staff. Is that, would that be their argument, do you think?
Well, I think that argument could be valid for people who see patients, which I'm not a physician, so I don't see patients. But they gave exemptions to faculty members who did see patients. So it wasn't a consistent policy for that reason. But there's also a third argument, which is an ethical argument. So for the sake of argument, let's assume that these are the perfect vaccines. There are no side effects. We know there are side effects, but let's assume they are not. Let's assume that they are 100% effective, which they're not, but let's assume. Then I don't need it. Other people don't need it. So you shouldn't, if you don't need it, you shouldn't take it, because at the time there were a vaccine shortage. So for example, my 87-year-old neighbor hadn't gotten it yet, and she is at high risk. And there were people both in the United States and across the world, in Latin America, Africa, Asia, and also in Europe, who hadn't gotten it yet because they didn't have enough doses to give out to people. So if there's a limitation on the number of vaccines available, then you shouldn't give it to people who don't need it, because that's unethical, because that means that somebody else who needed it didn't get it.
So if you're really pro-vaccine, in theory, you would not want to waste dosages on people who didn't need it.
Exactly. And I am very pro-vaccine. I think vaccines are a great thing. But that doesn't mean that everybody should get every vaccine.
I guess one other argument, I'm trying to kind of bring my brain painfully back to that period, but I do recall there was uncertainty about immunity-acquired infection, about how different strains may or may not behave. And it certainly was a surprising truth of COVID, wasn't it, that you tended to get it more than once? I mean, I've had it a number of times. Most people I know have had it a number of times. So it wasn't really the case that you just sort of got it and then you appeared to be immune thereafter.
So you still have immunity. So, but for measles, if you have measles, you will never get it again. But for coronaviruses, and that is, this includes the four previous coronaviruses that we have lived with for over a century, if you get them, you have immunity. So next time you don't get it as seriously, but you don't have complete immunity, so you can get it again. So the first time you get COVID, you're at high risk if you're old. But the second time then, it doesn't affect you as much. Until, I guess, you are 93 years old and you have a very weakened immune system there, and then you might die from COVID or from one of the other coronaviruses or from influenza or something.
Okay, so that's the hospital story. I think I understand that one. And then the University of Harvard, in terms of your faculty position, what did they do? What was their process to get you out?
So when I was fired, they put me on leave. That was their decision. And then they ended that at the end of last year. so that I was no longer on leave. So that sort of terminated my affiliation with the Harvard Medical School.
Did you protest it? Did you take action to fight against it?
Well, I asked them if I could continue as a professor at Harvard, and they basically says, "Well, you can apply for a job if you want to, if there's an opening somewhere."
Can you not sue for wrongful discrimination or wrongful dismissal or something like that?
So in the United States, people like to do that a lot. So maybe I could.
I'm pretty sure you could crowdfund an appeal if that's what you were going to do.
Yeah, but I'm from Europe, from Sweden. So we don't. That's not part of my culture to do that. So maybe I should or maybe I shouldn't. I'm not sure. My major concern is actually to help not just Harvard, but academia in general, to be more accepting of divergent viewpoints, and instead of having strict measures, and because there's been other problems before with Harvard that they were not very supportive of me speaking up against the lockdowns.
Yeah, I'd like to go through the history of that. I think that would be really useful. But just finally, on your professorship, will you apply elsewhere? Would you happily go back to Sweden? Would you take up a position at one of these more heterodox universities? You know, do you think there is a future for you in the academy somewhere?
I love Sweden, of course, so but I can't move there because I have young children in the US. So I will be wherever my children are. And that puts a restriction on actually moving also within. I'm a single father, which 50% custody of my 8-year-old twins, so I cannot move very far from where I am now.
So there are no other universities in the Northeast that you think might give you a job?
I don't know.
Well, let it be known. We're here on YouTube. If there's anyone watching and you're within an hour or two drive of somewhere to the west of Boston, send us a message. Let's have a talk a little bit about Harvard itself, because their behavior during this pandemic, I think most people would agree, was checkered at best and downright scandalous at worst. Let's go through Harvard's track record. So the beginning of 2020, there's the COVID outbreak. No one really understands what it's about. Already on March the 10th, by your account, Harvard unilaterally goes to remote learning. They shut all physical classes before it was mandated, before it was even recommended. Why did they do that?
That's a very good question. They sort of set the pace for the rest of the U.S. So they were among the first, I think they were the first major university, among the first universities to do that. And then other universities and colleges sort of followed along. Whatever Harvard does, we should do. And that then went also to high schools and elementary schools. And then eventually the government came in also to sort of institute this. So Harvard was definitely in the lead when it came to closing down schools and universities.
Was it the first university in the U.S. to shut?
It was at least the first major one. I haven't checked every university. But it's very surprising because we knew already at that time that while anybody can get infected, there was a 1,000-fold risk in mortality from the oldest to the youngest. So we knew that the students were not at risk. So maybe if you have an older profession, maybe they could have given their classes remotely while the students still were sitting in the classroom with teaching assistants. That would have been a reasonable approach, I think. But I don't think there was any public health reasons to close down the universities. And in fact, I think it made things worse because while the students are on campus, they will interact with each other and may infect each other. That is, they infect other low-risk people. Sending them home, living with their parents, or sometimes grandparents, they were more likely to infect vulnerable people. So I think it was actually a counterproductive move when it comes to protecting people's lives.
And what is that mindset? So it's this controversial decision. There'll probably be still now people who disagree with you, but there'll be a lot of people who feel that the closure of schools, certainly, and possibly also universities, was unnecessary and overly heavy-handed. That sort of attitude that Harvard demonstrates, which is so common in elite, progressive institutions, that they somehow need to be one step ahead of the curve. They need to take more action than everyone else. And that's sort of part of what they view as their leadership role. I think they would actually be proud of that. And yet in this case, it was potentially downright dangerous. Do you think there's something going on there, that there's, it's almost part of their self-image?
I think they could be right. So they maybe wanted to be the first because to set the sort of the stage for things and be the leader of things. But they could have done it the other way around and said, well, we're not going to close down. We're going to be sort of the pass setter for that. So they could have done it that way instead, I think.
And in fact, in terms of an academic principle, it doesn't feel very scientific or what you consider to be scientific on so little evidence to make such a dramatic move. So, yeah, at least some kind of humility, a greater sense of testing these decisions, refusing. As you say, they could have just refused to take government instructions and said, actually, we'll wait till hard evidence emerges before taking any drastic moves. You can almost see a parallel past there, where the universities acted as a bulwark against overly superficial politicians.
Yeah, that was a choice that Harvard made. And I don't know what the internal discussion was in the Harvard leadership, so I can't sort of address that.
You, however, spoke out from the beginning. Sometimes it felt like you were the only person in the world of seniority and rank who was disagreeing with lockdowns, disagreeing with these mandates as they began to come about. How did Harvard react to your rebellion?
Well, during the spring of 2020, they didn't really know because I tried to publish in the US without any success. I was able to publish in my native Sweden in the major daily newspapers, supporting the Swedish approach on not closing schools and not locking down. But I don't think that many in the Harvard read Swedish, so they probably wasn't even aware of that.
So did you send things to medical and scientific journals in the US and they were rejected? Or
I did send things to both scientific publications as well as sort of more general public mainstream media, and that was not accepted. In the early summer, Sweden came out with, the Swedish Public Health Agency came out with a report based on the Swedish experience of keeping schools and daycare open for all children ages 1 to 15, which, and out of 1.8 million children, there were zero who died from COVID. And there were only a few hospitalizations. And they also showed that the teachers were at no higher risk than other professions. So that was a very clear evidence that it was not dangerous to keep schools open. And of course, schooling education is important. But then a little bit after that, New England Journal of Medicine published an article about whether schools should be open or not by two Harvard professors. And they didn't even mention Sweden in their discussions. So that's like doing testing a drug, a new drug, and not having a placebo comparison group. And that's not how you achieve truth in the world of science. So that was very strange that they would completely ignore the one Western country that kept the schools open and did so very successful.
So your accusation then, put plainly, is that very senior scientists at Harvard willfully ignored inconvenient evidence in order to, I guess, tick a box of political convenience.
I will not argue with what you just said.
So your reputation starts firing up around the summer of 2020, right? Because that's when there's this controversy around Scott Atlas, who is another scientist who has been involved, who has actually joined the Trump administration. We did an interview with him from the White House, and he is then denounced by his Stanford colleagues in a big public letter, and you try and oppose it.
Yeah, so it was a very strange open letter by his Stanford, 98 of his Stanford colleagues, where they were accusing him of doing pseudoscience, even though he was just following the basic principles of public health. So I wrote a letter of support to the Stanford Daily, which is the student-run newspaper at Stanford, where I pointed out that there were many others who agreed with his approach, including the world's preeminent infectious disease technologist, Sonata Gupta at Oxford, and I invited them to have a debate, because that's fundamental for science, that we discuss science with each other and put different ideas and thoughts and theories against each other. But none of these 98 faculty members took up my offer. None of them wanted to debate me on this topic. So they were very happy to just slander Scott Atlas and accusing him of being pseudoscientific, but they were not willing to actually debate their arguments. And I think in terms of the public, it's very hard for the public to know who to trust, because scientists might say different things, and that's natural. So, but I think one criteria to use is a scientist who is not willing to debate their views with another scientist who is also sort of credentialed in the field. I don't think one should trust them. So if they don't have enough argument, if they don't want to do that, it means they don't have the arguments to actually do that discussion. I bet you shouldn't trust them.
Your views were called by Mark Lipsitch, one of your colleagues at Harvard, extreme fringe views. Is that, do you remember that?
Yes, I think that's what he said, yeah.
What do we make of that? Because it's quite an interesting choice of expression for one scientist to say about another. The fact that it's fringe means that it's sort of in the minority, doesn't it? It means it's not the same as most scientists. At least that was his claim, and therefore shouldn't be taken seriously. But you would think that a good scientific principle would be to keep on listening to minority views and not shut the door on them entirely. Or how do you react to that, hearing it back?
Well, I agree with you. And I try to keep the discussions at a polite. It can be very passionate. I think that's good. But I try to keep it on a polite level and not using those kinds of words.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So the Great Barrington Declaration, if we fast forward to October 2020, that's really where your global prominence kind of skyrockets. Looking back on that, do you feel that was a good thing to do? Do you feel it was well handled? Do you have any regrets about it? Do you feel it was mistreated? What's your overall memory of that period?
I have no regrets. I think it was a necessary thing to do because before that, there was a perception that there was consensus for lockdowns from among the scientific community. And I knew from my old colleagues that I talked to personally that there was not. And those of us who tried to speak out had a very hard time to do it. So we had to sort of somehow get through and burst that bubble of thinking that it was scientific consensus for this. Previously, like individual had been, Scott Atlas had been dismissed because he wasn't a card-carrying infectious disease epidemiologist, even though he's an expert on public health policy. Sunetha Gupta was sort of dismissed. You had a great interview with her, but many of us sort of dismissed. There's only one person. So the fact that there were three of us helped, and the fact that we all had experience with infectious disease epidemiology, and we were all at reasonably respectable universities, Stanford, Oxford, and Harvard, that sort of made it impossible to ignore. So we were able to sort of burst that bubble. And that sort of changed it. So instead of censoring and silencing, it was now slandering and smearing. But that's actually a lot better. So every time there was an article dismissing the Great Brexit Declaration in The Guardian or The Hill or wherever, they would include a link to the Great Brexit Declaration. So I would say, yes, good, because people are smart, so they will click on the link and then they will read the one page and say, well, this makes sense, and they are credentialed scientists who think so, so maybe there isn't a consensus for these lockdowns among the scientific community.
My memory of that era was, I confess, a little bit of frustration that you three didn't go further. Because for those of us who were trying to keep this discussion legitimate and alive and credible, one way that people shut down the Great Barrington Declaration was saying, well, they are talking about this thing called focused protection, where older or vulnerable people would be somehow protected and helped to isolate, but the rest of society could continue life as normal. But there was no detail as to how that might be achieved. You sort of said, well, we leave it to the scientific community or the public health professionals to work out how to achieve that. And so it became quite easy to say, well, they talk about this thing called focused protection, but everyone knows it's practically impossible because you have to have people coming in and out of care homes who are cleaning and cooking and looking after people, and young people live with older people. And so the idea of actually isolating a part of the community was never possible. That, I fear, was a big judgment on the Great Barrington Declaration. Do you feel you could have done more to explain and put detail on those views?
So that was a very common criticism, especially among the mainstream media, claiming that it was impossible and that we had no concrete proposals. But that was actually false. Because the declaration itself was only one page. So it only had, I think, two or three concrete suggestions about to protect the older people. But we also published an FAQ. It came out maybe a little bit later, a week or a couple of weeks later, where we actually had very detailed examples of what to do to protect older people. But that was very conveniently ignored when they criticized us. So we had very concrete proposals. For example, nursing home was a big problem, so there had to be less staff rotation. The fewer staff that people encounter, the less risk of getting infected. And we had people basically, people working in multiple nursing homes. We had needed more testing in nursing homes also. And we also suggested that older people, so what had happened now, some people could work at home, and 25-year-olds worked at home, even though they don't really were at risk. And then you had a 65-year-old cab driver who was driving the cab and being exposed at the high-risk person. So we suggested that there should be the possibility for high-risk people, working-class people who have these jobs to use Social Security on a temporary basis or some other method so that they can sort of be home during the heights of the circulations, which is not the whole year, but is sort of in the northern hemisphere, is during the winter. So we had several very, very concrete proposals for doing that. But that was very conveniently, I think, ignored by the mainstream media, who needed another sort of excuse for dismissing us.
Okay, let's fast forward now to 2021. In a way, the conversation changed then from being all about lockdowns and whether we should shut down the whole of society to arguments around the vaccine. That's when it really because the vaccine arrived in the spring of 2021, and it sort of dominated that whole second year of COVID. This is where you got in trouble because you were a you were attached to the CDC.
The COVID Vaccine Safety Working Group that they have sort of put together to sort of look carefully at the safety of these COVID vaccines on a sort of continuous basis. And we met usually once a week.
And you were dismissed from that as well?
I was, yes. I was fired from that committee.
Why?
I am probably the only person who has been fired by CDC for being too pro-vaccine.
Tell us that story.
So in the spring of 2011, there was a shortage of COVID vaccines. And the U.S. had approved three vaccines, two mRNA vaccines, the Pfizer Moderna, and one adenovirus vector vaccine, the Johnson & Johnson. And there was an approach from some blood clots from the J&J vaccines among younger women. So CDC decided to take a pause and not administer this vaccine for a while. And I think that was reasonable for younger women because that's where we saw the adverse reactions. But also they are at minuscule risk from dying from COVID. So they were not really needed this vaccine very much. But I argued against doing a pause for older Americans, because there was a shortage, they are at high risk. This was the one dose vaccine, so it's very important to reach hard to reach people, like people in rural areas where it's harder to give two doses, or so maybe homeless.
This
people.
Is just to be clear. This is the Johnson & Johnson vaccine,
correct? Yeah.
Which is not one of the mRNA vaccines that have also become right. very controversial. It's a more traditional vaccine where it introduces a kind of simulated version of the virus and you develop immunity to it.
Yeah, so it's a more traditional vaccine. It's a one dose instead of a two dose vaccine.
And why had they withdrawn it? Just because there was some adverse reactions among younger women, and so they pulled it completely?
Yeah, they said, we're not going to give it now. We're doing a pause while investigating this thing. And of course, that vaccine was not given anymore then. And it made a huge story in the media that this was sort of a dangerous vaccine. So I argued against it, saying that it's fine to do the pause for the younger women, but we should continue to give this vaccine to older Americans because there is a shortage and they need it. And it's very important to reach certain very vulnerable groups.
And you said this publicly.
Yeah, I wrote an op-ed in The Hill, which is a U.S. publication.
And so they actually dismissed you for being too enthusiastic about distributing vaccines. They wanted you to be more vaccine skeptical as regards the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
I guess so. Or they dismissed me because I wasn't on board with the official CDC policy on the matter. So they dismissed me. But then 4 days later, they did they lift the ban. But the publicity damage against the Johnson & Johnson has already been made, so people didn't quite trust it anymore. So it never recovered. The vaccine never recovered. It went back to the previous levels of distribution.
So on vaccines, there's been so much debate and discussion since. Many people have theories. There are still, no doubt, even people watching this video now or listening on the podcast who will wonder whether, even though some of those other vaccines, not just the mRNA ones, but the more conventional ones, whether they had more side effects than are generally recognized. What's your overall view now? Do you think there were very serious side effects? Do you think the numbers of people affected were high or small? Where are you at now? And of course, you can't be fired from anything, so you can say whatever you like.
So there's been two papers. One paper claimed that the vaccines killed 17 million people. Another paper claimed that it saved 14 million people. So obviously, both can't be true, but both of those papers are actually very weak, and I don't trust either of them. The problem is we don't have as good information as we should about these vaccines. When they were approved on randomized trials, which is good, but they were approved for reducing symptomatic COVID infections. And that's not what matters. I don't care if you are sick for a few days and have to stay home in bed. I care about you staying alive. So I care about death and to some extent hospitalizations. But the original trials did not evaluate death from this vaccine because they were not designed correctly. They enrolled young and mostly young and middle-aged people who would survive COVID whether they had the vaccine or the placebo. So they should have enrolled older people in their older people in the 70s and 80s and the 90s to actually know if this vaccine reduced mortality or not. So my feeling is that in 2021, when most people hadn't had the vaccine yet, had COVID yet, I think it saved lives for older people. It's a big question mark among children and younger people. I think that's unknown whether they did more harm or good. We know that there's certain adverse reactions, like, for example, myocarditis, especially in young men. Myocarditis is inflammation of the heart. But we don't have the full knowledge about all adverse reactions. Now, one thing that was done brilliantly by a group of Danish vaccine scientists, Christine Stable-Benn and others, she did something brilliant because the trials were too small to look at mortality. So she pooled them. So she pooled all the trials from the mRNA vaccines, Pfizer, Moderna, and then she pooled the trials from the other vaccines, AstraZeneca, Johnson & Johnson, and Sputnik. And then she evaluated all-cause mortality in both of those two groups separately, but those pooled analysis. Now, for the adenovirus vaccines, she found that there was a reduction in short-term mortality the point estimate was about 60% reduction, and based on the confidence interval, at least a 30% reduction. So it was very clear evidence that it made some good for this, both the young and middle-aged population in the short term. For the mRNA vaccines, that did not pan out. It was basically a null result. There was a 3% excess, but that's almost zero. And the confidence interval was there could have been maybe up to a 70% excess or a 30% reduction in mortality. But there was no evidence that the mRNA vaccines actually reduced mortality from those randomized trials.
To be clear, you're not one of those people who look at the overall excess deaths that are still elevated, or they're beginning to return to normal now, but they were elevated even throughout all of last year in most European countries, North America. You're not one of those people who correlates that in any way with the vaccine or thinks that they are related.
No, there's clearly excess mortality. But I think it would be wrong to sort of just assume that that's due to the vaccine. There has been excess mortality due to the COVID itself, of course, but we also have excess mortality due to the lockdowns, the collateral damage from lockdowns. So we know there's been excess mortality from cardiovascular disease, for example. And we, in terms of cancer, the fact that people didn't get their cervical cancer screening or their proper treatment for breast cancer or whatever, that increases mortality. Now, that doesn't show up immediately. So COVID mortality is not immediate. But the fact that you don't detect or treat cancer in 2020 doesn't mean that you're going to die in 2020. But it means that maybe you will die 2 years from now instead of living another 10 years.
So that's your explanation for the excess mortality. The fact that even today more people are dying than you would expect is still this long hangover from lockdowns and from the side effects. So people just not receiving treatment, people not going to hospital, undiagnosed issues, mental health issues, long-term chronic illnesses that came about during that period. It's all of those things having this sort of long tail.
Yeah, that's clearly causing excess mortality. Now, how much is hard to predict. But we certainly know that. And I mean, in the UK, Carlos de Cora has been very outspoken for a long time about these issues. He's doing a fantastic job to sort of try to point out to these problems and also to try to get remedies for it so that we can minimize that much.
If excess mortality, this leads me very nicely to something that I think we should spend a moment on, which is if excess mortality is a fair judge between countries or between states or between administrations for the wider period of this these unusual years. Let's put the chart on the screen that you yourself refer to sometimes. We've definitely talked about it, which compares all of the European countries' overall excess mortality between 2020 and the end of 2022. Bulgaria is there at the top. Roughly 20% more people died than you'd expect. Slovakia, Poland, Czechia, Romania, Lithuania, a lot of Eastern European countries had a really bad time of it. Then there are some Western European countries, and then you go all the way down to the bottom, and there you find Sweden with only a 4.4% increase, i.e. many fewer people died in Sweden proportionally than in any other country in Europe.
Yeah, I think that is the best measure, because one thing, you can define COVID mortality in different ways, but excess mortality is based on all deaths. So a death is a death. We can't really hide that. And it's basically compare the death in these 3 years with what you would expect that if it had the same death rate as in the prior few years. So I think that is the best overall measure. So it encounters both the effect on COVID as well as the effect collateral damage on other cancer and cardiovascular and mental health and so on. So I think that is the best, is the most relevant metric, and is the most reliable.
So do you deduce from that that the Swedish approach was the best?
Yes, I think very, very clearly so. It's, Sweden was criticized for sort of very harshly criticized for killing its citizens. And we see that they did really well.
Well, they literally killed fewer of their citizens than any other country in Europe, if this chart is correct.
No,
can
I
you
think
believe
that's the...
those statistics? Because I know there's, as always, when you put out something that goes against the dominant narrative, it gets challenged. And I know these statistics have been challenged. Some people say, depending on how you measure excess mortality in different ways, the hierarchy is slightly different. But at least in the alternative charts I've seen, Sweden, if not the very bottom, is second or third from the bottom. It's still almost at the bottom.
Yeah, so you can do it a little different. For example, the comparison, you can use 3 years prior years, so you can use five prior years. So that will move people kind of up and down a little bit. You can try to put a trend line in it. To me, that's not as good, but people can do that and then you get. But the key thing is that Sweden and the other Scandinavian countries, they are always in the bottom. And Denmark, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Finland, they were also, they closed schools for a while, but they were also quite light on the lockdowns. They sort of, I think, a little bit inspired by Sweden.
So why do you think it can be then? I mean, we've just had this hugely expensive, much publicized COVID inquiry here in the UK. Other countries are doing similar things. And yet, what we've just concluded here, what seems so self-explanatory from that chart as the most convincing single data point, is not widely accepted. In fact, it was explicitly excluded from the terms of the UK COVID inquiry. And frustratingly, even Sweden's own inquiry, which they did very quickly and halfway through this period, seemed to be very self-critical and talked about big mistakes being made. And the king then said, "We failed," and all sorts of things. And Sweden even managed to do its own reputation damage. So why is it that nobody, almost including Sweden, seems to want to observe its success?
I'm a simple scientist, and maybe journalists like you have a better ability to answer those questions.
Well, you've been thinking about it a long time, Martin. It's cost you your career, in a way, or at least your former career. And this is your country, Sweden. And I feel like you must have some sense of what's been going on there.
So I think that the Swedish approach, which was Anders Tegnell and Johan Giesecke, who were sort of the main architects of it, had a lot of support in Sweden from the public. There was an open discussion, and that was good. And I was part of that discussion, arguing, sort of supporting what they were doing. I think that people in Sweden don't really know how bad it was in other countries. They don't realize how bad the lockdowns were and school closures and stuff. So I think that's the sense I get. They don't know how lucky, Swedish people don't know how lucky they were.
Final question for you, Martin. It's a bit of a broad one, but having been through such an extraordinary experience, having gone from being an establishment Harvard professor quietly going about your business to being considered this much more controversial character and been literally fired from a number of positions, What is your main reflection on it? What have you learnt about the way the world works, about human nature? Do you now have a darker view? Has it made you cynical, or are you philosophical about it? How do you feel about it?
I'm concerned about the future. I'm optimistic, but I'm concerned. So one of the positive things is that so many people have sort of stepped up and objected to the kind of the authoritarianism, I think, that's spreading in both North America and Europe. I'm shocked that people don't think that freedom of speech should be obvious. I was censored by Twitter and LinkedIn and the YouTube and so on, and at the behest of the U.S. government. But those kind of censorship is, I thought we all agree that we should have freedom of speech, but I don't think there is that agreement anymore. And I think there are dark clouds both in the U.S. and in the European Union about this issue. So I'm concerned, but I'm also hopeful because there's more and more people speaking up and defending freedom of speech and defending academic freedom and defending consent to medical procedures. So in that sense, I'm optimistic, but we may be on the tipping balance. And I'm concerned about the future of science, because science can only operate properly and make progress if we have open discussions and academic freedom, and we avoid, we can have passionate discussions, but we should avoid slander and canceling. So I don't know what the future is for science. There's clearly much less trust in science, at least in the United States, for obvious and good reasons. But I think the rank and file scientists would have to sort of step up and make sure to put the ship straight again.
Professor Martin Kulldorff, I'm still going to call you that. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much, Freddie.
That was Martin Kulldorff, until recently a professor of medicine at Harvard. No longer. He has been fired for, he would say, getting COVID right. The statistics he was pointing to and we discussed there suggest that a lot of his hesitations were borne out. And yet, here we are, 3 or 4 years later, and Martin has lost his job. The world has sailed on. Very few people have apologized. Very few people have admitted they got anything wrong. It was a huge consensus between left and right. Here in the UK, all the political parties were clamoring for harsher lockdowns. There was a very strange unanimity in the public conversation throughout that period. And scientists who took a different view, who, if you look at that chart, as I am, it's quite hard to think that they got it terribly wrong. It seems more like they got it exactly right, have been banished. I found, personally, talking to him really quite moving, because here you have someone who is a sincere person. Maybe they got some things wrong, maybe they got some things right, but the idea that we would exclude someone like that from the public conversation, that we would consider they were no longer appropriate to hold an office at a top university, tells us a lot about what kind of society we are becoming. So thank you to him. Thanks to those who've been following us throughout this period. This was Unheard.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.